From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Rent control is making a comeback, with more than half of American renters spending more than 30% of their incomes on housing. Several states have made the bold move to impose some form of rent control. In February, Oregon became the first state to impose a statewide rent control policy. This month, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a new law transforming rental rules in New York City. Legislators in Washington and California have proposed bills they say will protect tenants and allow low-income individuals to find reliable housing. Now, there is housing pain and income inequality in many American cities, but does rent control meaningfully relieve those problems? The idea has long been considered a great way to depress a city's economic fortunes, but could that be changing? This hour on Point, the return of rent control. And you can join us. Do you want to reinstate some form of rent control where you live? What are its benefits? Or its negative effects? Is rent control an important part of a bigger package of solutions we need for housing in this country? Or does it directly make solving those bigger problems even harder? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we're going to start today in Oregon. And joining us now is Shamia Fagan. She's a Democratic state senator for East Portland. She sponsored Oregon's statewide rent control bill that Governor Kate Brown signed into the law in February. And she joins us today from Salem, Oregon. Senator Fagan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. It's an honor to be here.
It's great to have you. So first of all, tell us sort of broadly, what has Oregon's new rent control law, what is it introducing into the state's housing market?
It's basically two key principles, which provide tenancy stability during a tenancy. So number one is we've banned the practice of no-cause evictions after the first year of a tenancy. Here in Oregon, we saw tenants who had been longtime tenants suddenly displaced with just a 30 or a 60 or a 90-day notice, even though they had been paying their rent on time for years, following the contract, and being great neighbors. So after a first year of tenancy here in Oregon, we've now banned the practice of no-cause evictions. The landlord will actually have to have a legitimate cause in order to kick someone out of their home. And then second, we have a rent stability feature to our new law, which provides that during a tenancy, a landlord cannot raise the rent by more than 7%. Plus inflation, so roughly 10% per year.
Okay, so about those no-cause evictions, just what are some of the just causes, I guess, to use a phrase, that landlords could use?
Well, the most common ones, of course, would be not paying rent or criminal activity or material breach of the actual rental contract. We also created some new what we called landlord causes, which are still a for-cause eviction, but the tenant didn't do anything wrong. And those would be things like the landlord actually needs to take back the property because they're going to move their own self or somebody, an immediate family member, into the property. Or renovations are taking place that actually make the property unstable or unfit to live in, selling of the property to somebody who is owner-occupied. So those are what we would call landlord causes, and those are a reason that a landlord can end a tenancy, but we require them to actually provide that tenant with 1 month of relocation expenses to offset the burden of somebody being kicked out of their home when they were doing everything right.
I see. So the landlord would have to have cause plus pay that 1 month to the tenant in relocation expenses.
For the landlord causes, that's correct.
Okay, interesting. Now, so the 7% annual rent increase, the cap of 7% plus inflation, does the new law allow for, say you have a long-term tenant and the cap is in place, that once that tenant moves out, the landlord would be able to move the rent automatically to the new market rates?
Yes, which is really what distinguishes Senate Bill 608, which is what Oregon's new law was called when it was in bill form, with kind of the old school 1920s version of rent control that many people think of, is it does actually allow for any new tenancy. There's no limits whatsoever on what rent can be in charge, obviously other than what the market will bear. And so with any new tenancy, unless they've used that no-cause eviction within the first year, if they have, the landlord is given a no-cause eviction within the first year, they then can't resell set the rent during that first year. Really, we don't want to incentivize no-cause evictions in that first year.
Yeah.
But in any other instance where there's a new tenant, either they're evicted for cause or the tenant moves out, then there's no restrictions on what a landlord can charge a new tenant for rent in that property.
Okay. So, Senator Fagan, I have to say, before I joined the fabulous staff here at On Point to talk about national issues, I spent years following the housing market locally to where we are in Boston. And there was a 3-year-long battle to introduce some kind of rent control or rental adjustment policies in the city of Boston that failed. It failed pretty spectacularly. And yet here's Oregon passing a statewide law. I mean, you must have received pushback from developers, from landlords in Oregon. How did you get the law passed?
Well, Magna, first of all, thank you for the work that you did prior to joining On Point, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it was actually a little bit bigger than that. This bill was attempted and passed the Oregon House of Representatives 2 years ago in the prior legislative session and then died without a vote in the Senate, primarily because one Democratic senator, who was otherwise actually quite progressive, owned a couple of apartment complexes and was going to be a no vote and kill the bill. I then jumped in and primaried him as a Democrat and won on this issue. So in my Democratic primary last May of 2018, this was the hottest issue. It was a pure housing primary. The real estate interests and all those that don't want to see any kind of regulation to the rental market were lined up on my opponent, who was a 45-year incumbent Democrat. I then came in. I'd served previously in the Oregon House of Representatives, and I came in, and in a 3-way primary, one other person had jumped in the race. I got 63% of the vote against a 45-year incumbent who got barely 20% of the vote.
Uh-huh.
So this is a very hot issue. So we felt like that sent a message that this is something that Oregonians are ready to tackle. And so still, when we came in this session, there was extraordinary pressure to raise that cap, to provide all types of loopholes. And there are some tenant activists who would have actually preferred a stronger version
right.
of the bill in Senate Bill 608, a lower cap. And I would have actually supported a lower cap. But ultimately, we passed the bill with a bare majority over here on the Senate side.
Uh-huh.
So this was the best we could do this session. But certainly, as we see this play out, we're definitely interested in tinkering with it to make sure that it provides tenants the ultimate protection while making sure that we don't harm incentives for people to actually build housing, because we do have a housing shortage here in Oregon.
So I have to ask you about this, because this is the strongest pushback, which we've seen for decades now, to the idea of rent control. It's the one thing that brings economists together from all parts of the political spectrum, that if you cap rent and the rate that rent can grow, it is a major dissuader for building new housing, for development. And we are in a place, not just in Oregon, but nationwide, where one of the major solutions has to be to open up the housing market and get new stock out there. How can you confidently say that having rent control will not stymie the creation of new units, especially in a place like Portland that you represent?
That's a great question. So we were very concerned about that, because we want to make sure that we're not disincentivizing development, because we are about 150,000 units short statewide right now in Oregon. And so we need to be building units, and we're taking a yes-and approach, not an either-or approach. We have some other legislation that hopefully you'll be hearing about soon that is actually we are considering statewide banning single-family zoning in Oregon, and make sure that we can allow duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes on any property that otherwise meets city signing and siting and design requirements. So we are definitely, and developers, of course, are thrilled about that. And that's something that we're also working on, because we want to take a multifaceted approach. But there's a key in our bill, Magna, that we made sure to work with, which is we actually provided a 10-year exemption for any new construction. And that's not only new construction built after the date that this law went into effect, which was February 28th of this year, but also any building that's currently out there that has an occupancy certificate that's 10 years or less. So we exempted those new developments from that cap to really try to strike that right balance between not disincentivizing disincentivizing development. And then also, as we previously mentioned, you can still, at the end of a tenancy, reset that rent to market rate.
So a couple more questions for you, Senator Fagan. This is absolutely fascinating. I'm wondering why you needed a statewide law. Why do places like, I don't know, I'm just throwing some names out there, Grants Pass, Albany, LeGrand, places that are far away from the Portland metro area, why do they need a rent control law?
because we have a statewide housing crisis. In fact, people often focus, of course, on the Portland metro area where rents are really, really high. But actually, the data that we saw, I chaired the Senate Housing Committee, and we did an incredible amount of in-depth research on this. And actually, so Oregon is the highest rate of homeless kids per capita of any state in the country. And Multnomah County, which is that big county that really encompasses Portland and the Portland metro area, is like, I think, not even in the top 50% of Oregon counties facing homeless students. And we know that rent-driven homelessness is really the leading cause of homelessness here in Oregon. And so it really is a statewide problem, and it needed a statewide solution.
Okay, so we just got 2 minutes left to go here, Senator Fagan. Last question for you. Has housing instability touched you or your family?
Yes, thank you for asking. My mom experienced homelessness for most of my childhood. My dad raised me as a single parent in rural Oregon, and we actually went to visit my mom one time when I was a teenager. My big brother drove us up there. We hadn't seen her in a couple of years. She'd been living on and off the streets and battling addiction, and I remember we pulled up to this huge house, kind of a Victorian-style house with a big wraparound porch, and obviously we hadn't seen her in a couple of years. We were thrilled. We were impressed at her house. And she walked us around to the front steps, but instead of walking up the steps, she dropped to her hands and knees and crawled under the porch and then invited us into her home. And so my teenage brother and I spent the afternoon with her in her home. And obviously, you know, most people that experience homelessness don't have a storage unit or a U-Haul. And so my mom really had kind of one box of stuff that she kept with her, and it was full of pictures and letters from us. And it was one of those really... You know, I was about 15 at the time. It was one of those moments that struck me and said, you know, everybody who's out there experiencing homelessness for whatever reason, if it is addiction, you know, it's somebody. And that's what my mom wanted from that box. It was always to remember that she was our mom, that she belonged to somebody. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I've really carried with me in my service as a legislator, is to not just look at people experiencing homelessness for whatever reason and think that they're not worth us putting in effort and standing up to special interest in the powerful real estate lobby to make sure that they have a place to call home.
Well, Oregon State Senator Shamia Fagan joining us from Salem, Oregon. She's the sponsor of Oregon's statewide rent control bill that Governor Kate Brown signed into law in February. Senator Fagan, thank you so much for joining us.
It was an honor, Magna.
We are talking about the return of rent control in places like Oregon. New York State just signed a similar bill this month. Washington and California are considering it as well. Do you welcome the return of rent control? I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the return of rent control. Oregon in February passed a statewide law issuing putting some caps on rents in that state. New York State this month signed a similar bill. There are pieces of legislation being considered in Washington and California. And we want to know what you think. In the incredibly hot housing market where you might be living, or in a world where wage stagnation has dogged workers for decades, is rent control a good solution to housing instability across the United States? Or, as it has been considered for decades, is rent control still one of the best ways to pull the rug out from underneath a city that's experiencing a growing economy? Let's listen to some of the reaction from Oregon. This is real estate broker Matt Williams. He spoke to NBC affiliate KGW in February. Prior to Oregon's rent control legislation, he had concerns about the new law.
It really is an emotional and political response to an economic problem. And economists across the state, and I would assert across the country, all say that this is not an effective way to go.
Well, over in New York City Council, City Council Speaker Corey Johnson spoke out in favor of universal rent control in his city at a march for fair housing in April.
Are we going to be a city where only the richest can live, where you have to make a 6 or 7 figure salary to survive in New York City? Or are we going to be a city where working people can survive? And that is what this movement is about.
Well, we do have some economists who are going to join us in a minute, but this is an issue that is very important to a lot of people. So let me just let a couple of callers in first. Let's go to Eva, who's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Eva, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. There is a movement here in Providence to cap rent at about 4%. And as a landlord of 15 years, here are my two pieces of concern that I expressed to them. In the past, our taxes have gone up by $1,000 in 1 year. Currently, our assessment has gone up by 40%, and that's quite a jump, and we're waiting to see what that does to our overall taxes, which are pretty high here in Providence. So if the rental market goes up and we've kept our rent low for existing great tenants, that cap is really a killer for us. That's number one. And number two, when landlords rent out whole apartments to, you know, through Airbnb, what does that do to the market overall? And so I don't think that rent control should be implemented without including this piece.
Right. Eva, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Marie, who's calling from Indian Rocks Beach, Florida. Marie, you're on the air.
Hi there. I agree that everybody needs to have rent control, even the Airbnb. But my concern is that the larger portion of people who rent complexes, apartments, are the wealthier. And the for one individual to have to put out more than 70% of their income just to survive means the money goes into one pocket, the renters, I mean the owner of the complex, and not back into our regular businesses, small businesses, local businesses, because we're putting all our money into their pocket. So again, it's a way to keep the classes separated and to keep working people from ever getting ahead.
Right.
It's impossible.
Well, Marie, thank you so much for your call. So two calls there from Rhode Island and Florida, with two very different views about rent control. So let's hear from some economists about this. Let's first of all introduce to the conversation Christopher Palmer. He's joining us in the On Point studio today. He's a professor of finance at the MIT Sloan School of Management. His research focuses on credit, real estate, and labor markets, and he's the author of a 2012 study titled Housing Market Spillovers, Evidence from the End of Rent Control in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor Palmer, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. As a listener and fan, it's an honor to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have anyone on our program. Let's also introduce into the show today Stan Van Nieuwenberg. He is a professor of real estate and finance at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business, author of a 2018 study, Affordable Housing and City Welfare. And he joins us from New York. Professor Stan Van Nieuwenberg, welcome to you.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So, Professor Palmer, I just want to start with you, and I want to go back to what seemed to me a basic assumption for decades, that rent control was harmful to the economic well-being of American cities. As I mentioned in the previous segment, that it seemed to be one thing that united economists from all perspectives. Is that no longer true?
I think on the whole, economists are still united that rent control has a lot of side effects. And it clearly has benefits as well for the people that are protected by rent control laws. And I think that's why it keeps coming back. We have an affordability crisis, and there is a deserving set of people that are renters, and they're struggling.
So, but let's talk about what those presumed negative effects were, right? Because we've had decades where rent control laws were wiped off the books. In some of the very cities right now that are booming and facing these extremely high rent prices. So what were the reasons to get rid of rent control?
Well, if you think about two goals of affordable housing policy, one is to make affordable housing more accessible, and the other is to prevent current residents from being priced out of their home. Rent control does a good job at helping current residents stay in their home, but it arguably backfires at making affordable housing more accessible.
How?
So that is the pernicious effect of the fact that if you're going to cap rents, it's going to reduce incentives for people to supply housing. That might not be new housing. Modern laws try to keep full incentives for supplying new housing, but people are more likely to convert to condos or to occupy their own unit. And so we have a lot of leakage from the system. Rents end up rising for everybody else, it becomes harder to find a rent-controlled apartment. Everyone's staying there for a long time, and it makes the problem worse.
So, Stan Van Nieuwenberg, let me ask you, is this not sort of basic presumption of one of the potential negative effects of rent control still true? I mean, that's what we talked about when we spoke to the senator from Oregon, that could it possibly not suppress the development of new housing, which is ultimately what many of these cities need?
Hey, Megan, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it certainly has these kind of downsides in terms of affecting the supply of new housing, the maintenance of the existing housing stock. Landlords are disincentivized by those rent control programs for them doing so. It also creates, in my view, a lot of housing misallocation where the wrong type of tenants end up in a lot of these affordable housing units. Maybe they were low income when they first qualified for these units, but then over time, maybe just because they're aging, their incomes go up and they make actually quite a lot of money, yet they're allowed to stay in these units. So I think this housing misallocation problem is also an important feature of the system.
Okay. No. It seems to me that the popularity of new rent control laws, it's based on real pain, right? I mean, we've been throwing these numbers around that half of American renters or at least are spending, 30% of their income, a huge amount of rent every year, a significant amount more, spending more than 50% of their income. So I want to acknowledge that there's real housing pain out there. But Professor Van Nieuwenberg, is rent control sort of an immediate short-term relief, though, that doesn't do much to address the longer-term structural problems that led to where we are?
Well, that may well be, Magna, but I would like to emphasize, even in the short run, exactly that there are these benefits from having affordable housing units for low-income tenants. You know, my research shows that you could think of rent control and affordable housing policies more broadly as providing an insurance for essentially, against the loss of a job. If the loss of a job, for example, leads one to also lose one's house, it is actually valuable to provide insurance against this. And this is what some of these rent control policies can actually do. So I think as long as needy households are the ones who are ultimately the beneficiaries of this insurance, my research shows that there can be large benefits from provision of this insurance and benefits that are large enough to outweigh these costs that we were just talking about.
Okay, so in a couple minutes, we'll talk about how we assure that the right households are the benefits of these policies, as you're saying there. But Professor Palmer, let me turn back to you. I mean, you've done a study here about titled Housing Market Spillovers, Evidence from the End of Rent Control in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What did you find there?
So we found that right before the end of rent control units in Cambridge were renting at about a 40% discount. So it was a pretty steep discount. And afterwards, there were a lot of things that changed about neighborhoods in Cambridge. One is that there was a 7-year boom in renovations. So we could see this as evidence that some of these units were under-maintained or at least not to what their landlords could have benefited from. And so we see this boom in renovations. We do see some turnover. We see property values rise. And we actually see crime go down in these neighborhoods as people start to really invest in these neighborhoods. And one interesting thing is we only saw 7% of tenants apply for a hardship exemption. They could have made the case that, look, I can't afford to pay market rents. I should have an extension of my rent control. And maybe they just didn't know about that program. But it seems like there were actually not as many people that needed it as we might have thought.
So there are many people who would argue that the government getting out of the way of the housing market, of stepping back from rent control, is the thing or one of the major things that allowed for this boom that you're describing.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why Cambridge has been booming since the 1990s, and there are a lot of job growth in Cambridge. But it does seem like in the neighborhoods that had been heavily rent controlled, there was an upgrading of those neighborhoods on many dimensions.
Other people would call it gentrification.
That's right. And when we see things like crime going down, that's maybe a positive effect of gentrification. When we see things like displacement, that's arguably a negative effect of gentrification.
All right. Well, on this point, let's go to a call. Andrew is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Andrew, you're on the air. What do you think about the return of rent control?
Thank you very much. So I think that it needs to be balanced alongside people's personal property rights. The senator speaking about the right to a person's home, well, what about the right to a person's property? It's not actually their home. It's the renter's property. Now, of course, there can be things within reason done. such as incentives and disincentives, both on the renting market and as far as paychecks are concerned, incentivizing employers via tax breaks to pay more. But to take away someone's personal property rights, I think goes against what it means to be an American.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you so much for your call. So Stan Van Nieuwenberg, what's your response to that? Because we are talking about personal property, whether it be homes or units owned by small landlords, or even in, you know, a corporation might be owning thousands of units, but nevertheless, it's the private property of that corporation. Why should the government be interfering with what they can and can't do with it?
I mean, I think ultimately this goes back to the question of provision of welfare in society. And, you know, we have progressive taxation where, you know, the government taxes high-income earners in order to redistribute to less fortunate individuals. You could argue our human capital is also, you know, our own property. And so why does the government have the right to tax my human capital? I think ultimately this is the same question. And ultimately this boils down to, as a society, where do we want to fit on that trade-off between, you know, efficiency and redistribution, equality and efficiency? Mm-hmm. I think all of economics comes back to where on the spectrum do you want your society to be? And I think, you know, the fact that a lot of Democrats have returned to control in a lot of different places has kind of tilted that balance towards, you know, more redistribution, more equality. And I think this is, you know, the whole rent control debate is a good example of that.
Professor Palmer, did you want to have a response to that?
Yeah. So an interesting point is that normally the way we solve this problem, if someone is committed to staying in a community and doesn't want to be priced out, is through homeownership, and someone would buy a house. And it's no coincidence that the same price pressures that are inspiring rent control conversations around the country are also places where homeownership seems impossibly unattainable. So you need some kind of insurance, and the normal way of providing it, where you own your own home and you can fix your housing cost for as long as you have that home, is seemingly out of reach.
For a multiplicity of reasons, right?
Absolutely.
Inadequate housing stock, stagnant wages for an entire generation of young people, burdensome student loans. I mean, this is a multifactorial problem, which is actually why rent control sort of surging again as a popular policy tool is really fascinating to me. So Stan Van Nieuwenberg, you heard a couple of minutes ago Christopher Palmer talking about his research in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and how and the positive effects that the removal of rent control had on that city. Tell me about your 2018 study about that you found that the expansion of rent control, in fact, the opposite thing, could increase the welfare of a city. What did you find?
That's right. So I think the first result of my study is basically to think about who are the tenants who are in rent control and what is the efficiency of the rent control system, right? So this is like holding fixed the amount of affordable housing we set aside. How can we best allocate it to people across the income distribution? And what I'm pointing out there is that there's a lot of misallocation in the current housing system. And by fixing that, we could actually generate large welfare gains. So that is kind of the main finding of the paper. It's really keeping the size of the housing, of the affordable housing system, constant and kind of allocating it more fairly. Now, in addition to that, I do find that a modest size expansion of affordable housing can be good for society. And the intuition is really very simple. It's that this type of affordable housing system really benefits the poor. It benefits people who just lost their job, and for whom housing stability is incredibly valuable. You know, that's not to say that it doesn't cause all kinds of distortions. It does. It affects, you know, incentives to supply new housing. It generates this misallocation in the housing system. So there are a lot of costs to the system, but there's also important benefits, and benefits that are very concentrated on very needy people. And that's ultimately why I find that there can be that expansions of affordable housing can actually be welfare improving.
Okay, so forgive me for I'm a little confused. Is rent control the same thing as expansions of affordable housing? Because in my mind, they're different.
Right. So, I think of affordable housing as kind of the umbrella name for a range of policies, you know, one of which is rent control or rent stabilization. You know, another one is something that's very popular in New York City, which is called mandatory inclusionary housing, where a developer may get the right to build on a lot and be able to build much more, a much larger building, let's say, than what's currently permitted under zoning rules, as long as that new building has a certain fraction of apartments that are set aside for lower income tenants.
Okay.
And so that too is a very effective way, I think, of providing affordable housing units.
Christopher Palmer, we've just got to take a break here in a minute. Did you have a response to Stan Van Nieuwenberg's view about the positive effects here?
Yeah, I mean, my read of their study, and I have tremendous respect for these authors, is that in theory, a successfully targeted affordable housing policy could be terrific. And I think one of the nuts that we're trying to crack politically is how do you target it so that the right people, the most needy and the most deserving people, are the people that are getting these units?
Yeah. Well, we are talking this hour about the return of rent control. In February, the state of Oregon became the first state in the nation to pass statewide rent control laws. New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo, just this month passed rent control or sweeping reform of rental laws in the state of New York, specifically around New York City. Washington, California, considering similar bills. What do you think? Do we need rent control in America, or does it produce greater harms than good? This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the return of rent control to at least a couple of states in the United States. And some other places are considering legislation that would reform rental laws. I have to admit, by being based in Boston, this is an issue that I've followed for quite some time. And back in 2015, I spoke with Lisa Owens-Pinto. She's director of community organizing for a group called City Life Vita Urbana in Boston. We once took a walk through the neighborhood of East Boston, and she pointed out all the buildings to me where rents were rapidly rising.
East Boston used to be one of the most affordable places to live, right? And so we see folks coming into our weekly meetings on Wednesday talking about, you know, my, you know, 50% rent increases, sometimes 100% rent increases.
Sometimes 200%.
Sometimes 200% rent increases. So if 30% is the average, the folks who are the most vulnerable have it even worse.
That's Lisa Owens-Pinto from City Life Vita Urbana in Boston. And the idea of rent control is gaining steam in Boston, but also pushback as well. And that pushback is coming in other cities, too. Here's Mike Glasser, president of the Chicago Neighborhood Building Owners Alliance. He spoke at the Illinois State Capitol in March in opposition to a proposed bill that would repeal the state's ban on rent control. Here's Glasser.
Let me just say that owning apartments, I would be very hard-pressed to upgrade the appliance package, change the windows, build a new porch, replace the furnace, tear off and replace a roof. If I'm in an environment where my taxes are going up, my energy prices are going up, the costs across the board are going up, and I'm being told by a rent control board that I cannot raise my rents to justify the investment.
That's Mike Glasser in Chicago. Christopher Palmer, respond to that, because this is something that many landlords will say, that their prices continue to go up. We heard taxes, maintenance. But if they're not allowed to keep up with those prices, ultimately what's going to suffer is the housing stock itself.
Yeah, I think there's a trade-off here, and modern rent control policies ideally address this. They say things like, if you need to perform abnormal maintenance or we have an increase in your cost because of utilities or taxes, we're going to allow an abnormal rent increase. And so there are policies that try to solve that. I'm not sure if the ones that are currently on the table do, but that is a real issue. Often the landlords we're talking to feel very squeezed. And I've talked to landlords that say, the tenants that I'm renting to make much more than I do, and I'm subsidizing them while I'm being squeezed with costs rising for me.
So again, this question of do these policies support the people who most need it and in the right way? Well, let's go back to the phones. Chuck is calling from Dover, Delaware. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I support rent control. I live in Delaware, and I see all these little towns, all the nice, cute little Victorian houses and first-time buyer-type houses that I would be looking for if I was a young guy are getting bought up by the landlord class. And they fill them with people, usually too many. It drives the socioeconomic desirability of the town down. It makes it very hard for a first-time buyer to buy a house because they got to compete against the landlord class who doesn't spend a penny on the houses. It's just an extraction of wealth. They take the money from the renter. They take the infrastructure from the town, and they don't do anything. I really have a hard time feeling sorry for that investor class. Mm.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Jake, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Jake, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was a teenager in the 90s when rent control was on its way out. And, one of the impacts that I observed was a change in the mix of businesses. A lot of our favorite independent coffee houses and bookstores and others couldn't afford the rents in the commercial side either. And I'm wondering if any of the researchers have had any.
Jake, looks like we lost your call there, but I was just going to say that, yes, because what neighborhoods need are more banks and cell phone stores, right? So, Jake, thank you so much for your call. But Stan Van Nieuwenberg, respond to what Jake says. Are there sort of social benefits, I guess he's pointing to, when you reinstate rent control?
Yes, Magna, I think it's definitely a fact that, the retail mix might change. And that's kind of, again, I think a consequence of the gentrification we were talking about before. Like as higher income tenants move in, the retail landscape in that neighborhood will probably change with it, sometimes to the loss of these independent retailers. I do think that economists are not very good about thinking about this, but I do think there's something to be said for having socioeconomic diversity at the neighborhood level. I think part of what is driving this push for more affordable housing is this idea that, cities like New York City are losing 50,000, 100,000 rent-stabilized housing units pretty much every year for decades now. And it's affecting the ability of having economic diversity in every part of the city.
Mm.
And so to the extent that that is a valuable thing by itself, and I think there's some evidence from, looking at, having poorer kids move to better school districts, for example, that there are these positive externalities from having mixed neighborhoods, that those considerations play a role as well.
Yeah. So we keep sort of circling around this question of how does a rent control policy help the right people? Right people meaning those who need the most assistance, who are the most squeezed. And Stan Van Nieuwenberg, I wonder if you think it does, because it's a blanket policy. Are there ways to sort of tweak rent control regulations where, just throwing out some ideas here, sort of income linked rent control or assistance to the kind of landlords we've been hearing from on the phones who say that they couldn't keep up their units if a cap was placed on rental increases, because rent control it can't stand alone as a solution.
Right. So I think in New York City, for example, the new laws that just came into effect last week, they essentially ban something that's called high rent or high income vacancy decontrol. And what that policy used to be is that whenever a tenant's income exceeds $200,000 a year, essentially that apartment can automatically become decontrolled as long as the rent is also above $2,750 a month, which is actually not that high a rent level in New York City. And so a lot of these apartments automatically became decontrolled when the income of the tenant became too high. Now, of course, that then means that apartment is no longer an affordable unit available for somebody else. So we were losing that apartment before. Under the new rules, that vacancy decontrol is no longer allowed. And so as a result, that $200,000 tenant or higher is now allowed to stay in that affordable housing unit. So in some sense, you know, we're still not getting that apartment back to a you know, a lower income tenant. So the rules, the new rules, do nothing to improve the allocation of housing to lower income tenants, which in my view is in some sense a missed opportunity. In my view, the whole goal of affordable housing policy is to bring these units to lower income households who need them the most, not to subsidize somebody making $200,000 a year.
Right. So Christopher Palmer, respond to that, because that this does seem to be kind of one of the central conundrums that even people who welcome rent control recognize.
Yeah, and there's a political question of if you means tested it, could you ever get the will to be able to get something through? And I think that's one of the reasons why it's generally been hard to find such policies that have that. But I mean, this is in the backdrop. There was a Wall Street Journal study last week that most of the beneficiaries of rent control in Manhattan are wealthy and white. And the San Francisco Rent Board in 2002 found that one in four rent control tenants was making over six figures. And that was in 2002. And they kind of stopped asking the question after that. So there's this worry of this misallocation, absolutely.
I mean, San Francisco is an interesting case, right? Because even with its rent control, it's done nothing to stabilize the housing market overall.
Yeah, it's hard to know the counterfactual. San Francisco has just been growing so strongly over decades with so much job growth, as have many of the cities that we're talking about.
Right. But so this is the thing that in the cities we've been talking about, not just coastal. I mean, and we did our housing series. Nashville's booming. There's lots of places in America that people want to go to, and they will continue to want to go to. Rent control doesn't change that dynamic. It doesn't increase the available housing for the people who want to live in these places.
Yeah, one statistic I saw from KQED was that to keep up with population growth, the state of California needs to build 180,000 housing units a year, and they actually build 80,000 units a year. And I think that similar dynamic is playing out in a lot of different places where they have this ongoing deficit of housing that just creates this big mismatch.
Right. So Stan Van Nieuwenberg, on that point, earlier in the hour when we were talking to the Oregon State Senator, she said that in addition, they're considering things like to tackle the housing issue overall, removing single-family zoning from any city or town in the state of Oregon, or perhaps finding other ways for the state to subsidize development if developers feel reluctant to, given the new rent control laws there. I mean, are those parts of a bigger solution that states need to look at?
Absolutely. I think, the zoning and the supply side of housing is absolutely crucial and needs to be thought about in concert with these other housing affordability policies that we're talking about. So, for example, zoning, and some of this does not need to cost the city anything. Zoning rules can be changed. And, for example, a place like Manhattan, as dense as it may seem, is not nearly as dense as some other cities in the world, like Hong Kong. So we could easily fit twice the population of Manhattan on the island of Manhattan if we changed the zoning laws. Now, I'm not advocating for such a radical change, but I do think that, there's a lot of room or a lot of scope for a policy called upzoning, where we're increasing the density, especially in the city center. And every time you increase supply, the cost of housing will fall. So this is definitely a policy that will work, and that I think is an important part of the solution. Well, I also like the Minnesota and the Oregon idea about single family zoning. That too, I think, is of banning single family zoning. That too, I think, is a good policy to pursue.
But maybe a tough one when neighborhoods themselves start pushing back on that. But let's go quickly to the phones. Dan is calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to add to this that in 2008, there was a consortium of people that bought up all the homes and rental properties, or homes of people that used to have homes, and created these huge corporations that they rent out now, controlling the market. So you don't really have a choice. You're paying the rent. And not only when you rent an apartment, it's almost as if you're buying it, because you're being investigated, so to speak. They look into your background. They don't want any riffraff, anybody that has any problems in the past, and they really scrutinize you. I felt like I was getting a mortgage.
Mm. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Ono, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Ono, you're on the air.
I just wanted to add, I'm somebody that's worked in real estate development almost 5 years now, specifically in Miami, Florida, and I've seen that a lot of foreign buyers are starting to buy in a lot of the gateway cities where you see a real crunch for affordable housing. I really think that the government has to intervene, and there has to be some sort of taxation to create some sort of housing fund that's distributed through the states to kind of help solve that and maybe help alleviate the fact that states are now thinking about affordable rent control.
Uh-huh. Ono, thank you so much for your call. So Christopher Palmer, let me turn back to you on this, because Ono's point about foreign investment in the U.S. housing market, a couple of people actually wanted us to talk about this. Someone called themselves Regular Person said, I've heard that wealthy international investors are pouring money into U.S. housing and aggravating the housing shortage. And then in addition to, in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, lots of private equity firms were able to buy up thousands of distressed homes and control big parts of the rental market in some parts of the United States. So does rent control do anything to shift those fundamental dynamics in the housing market?
I think one of the reasons that a lot of real estate in the United States is attractive for private equity firms or for foreign money, for example, is precisely because we have a lot of supply constraints and it's hard to build more housing. And so your investment is in some sense protected, and you know it's going to be valuable for the long run because it's hard to build housing in a lot of the cities that need it the most. And so I do think there's a bit of a miscommunication, if I can say this. Economists often say, well, the solution's going to be supply. And then people will look at the data and say, where are the promised rent decreases now that we've had a little bit of an increase in supply? And I don't think what we mean, and we need to do a better job communicating this, is that an increase in supply is going to lead to outright decreases in rent. The idea is that the problem will be even worse if we don't continue to build. And so I think that's one of the pressures that we see in areas where foreign money's coming in or areas where there are other pressures on price and homeownership becomes unattainable, is that there is this difficulty of supply, and that points to these policies like densification.
Okay. So Stan Van Nieuwenberg, we've just got a couple of minutes left. We have this interesting comment that's come in from Alex Cummings, who says, it's fascinating to see that so many things seem taboo to free market ideology. Tariffs, rent control, for example, just a few years ago have become part of the policy discussion again. Have people lost faith in the market? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that might be too strong a statement. I think economists have come to realize that there's trade-offs and that there's a lot of heterogeneity in the population. You know, with respect to tariffs, we've come to understand that, you know, on average, there are gains from free trade, but there are winners and losers from this change. And we've started to worry more about those who are losing from this policy and thinking about ways of potentially compensating them. And I think the same discussion is occurring for rent control. You know, the cities are in some sense a victim of their own success. They're wonderful magnets of talent. They're flourishing, but that pushes up the cost of housing. And so we realize that that now creates losers, in particular the people who were there before and now risk being uprooted. And we're thinking of policies to somehow compensate those victims of that economic success. Right. So I think that's kind of it's not that we've lost faith in the market. It's that we realize that these market dynamics are causing winners and losers.
Well, Christopher Palmer, last thought for you today. I mean, the very basis of we started here, right? That the very basis of the success in many of these cities is what's causing the pain as well.
Yeah, I think ultimately the question we all have to ask is, are the side effects and the unintended consequences of rent control, do they outweigh the benefits? And we have some sense of what the benefits and the side effects are, and we need to see if some of the recent policy proposals are going to be enacted and wait to see how things play out.
Well, we have a really big data set coming from several states now in the coming years. So Christopher Palmer, professor of finance at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was an honor, Magna.
And Stan Van Nieuwenberg, professor of real estate and finance at Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. Thank you as well.
Great to be with you.
And here's one last comment from listener Sue Butler, who says, if wages had actually kept pace with inflation and the income gap between the top 1% and the rest of us not so obscenely huge, people would be able to afford rent, eat well, save a little for their future, and support their communities. We need a true living wage for workers and the elimination of obscene payouts at the top. So find us on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio and let us know what you think about the return of rent control. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.